This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Holocaust survivors from around the world gathered in Poland this week to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It was the largest of the Nazi death camps. Over 1 million people died there. 90% of them were Jews. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from writers and musicians who have created works about the Holocaust. First, writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. He's leading the U.S. delegation at the 50th anniversary commemoration. Wiesel survived Auschwitz and Buchenwald, and he has devoted his life to bearing witness to the Holocaust. He grew up in Hungary. When he was 15, Hungarian Jews were forced by the Nazis to live behind barbed wire in a ghetto. In 1944, before Wiesel turned 16, he and all of the Jews in town were deported to concentration camps. Both his parents and one of his sisters died in the camps. We spoke in 1988. Why have you made it your life work to bear witness?
Well, what else could one do? Having gone through certain events, I believe a human being, if he or she wants to remain human, then he or she must do something with what we have seen, endured, witnessed. Not to live through an experience when the experience is there, it's bad. But not to communicate it is worse.
You know, I think that it's almost a human instinct to let time dim memories of horror and tragedy. Have you fought that in a way? Have you tried to keep those memories alive so that you can continue to communicate about them?
Well, naturally. I mean, naturally, the human being wants to forget pain. In this case, all those, or most of those, who went through the experience during the war, they want to remember more and more and more. They go deep into their own consciousness, into their own memory, trying to find more events, more faces, more eyes, more words, more sighs, more tears, more agonies. It's never enough because we feel that we have to tell the story, and no one can tell the story fully.
You once described Auschwitz as the defeat of the intellect that wants to find a meaning with a capital M in history. Do you feel that nevertheless you've been really spending your life trying to find some meaning of the Holocaust, some larger meaning it could tell us about man or about God?
Terry, all the questions I had remain open. I really don't believe that I found any answer to any one of the questions I had. I don't know the meaning. I don't know why it happened. I don't know how it happened. I still don't know anything, really. I'm trying to tell a story, and even the story cannot be told, and therefore it cannot be communicated, and therefore people deep down, I know, won't receive the testimony that we are giving. We are a very special kind of writers, those who write about that event. And I write very little about it, really, but I know that people will not understand.
I think when you were in the camps, you saw some religious people stop praying and saw people who had not been observant turn to God. You had been very observant and very immersed in the religious texts when you were young, before you were deported to the concentration camps. How did your experiences and your survival in the camps change your own experience of religion?
Well, the change, to the extent that it occurred, did not occur there. It's afterwards that the problems became urgent. Inside that universe, we continued praying, we continued believing, we continued affirming. We needed that link with our past. It's only after the war that I began asking questions. And I began articulating a certain protest. And that protest is still with me. I am still angry at all the forces in history that provoked such a catastrophe. That doesn't mean that my fate left me or that I left my fate. I try to develop a certain protest within fate.
Have you gone back to the religious texts that you were reading when you were young?
I never stopped reading or studying. Even inside that universe, I studied. I had a teacher there who whose name I never knew and whose face I hardly saw. But he was a teacher, head of a Talmudic school in Galicia. And we worked together and we studied together. I know it's incredible.
This is in the camps?
Inside, in Auschwitz. So we studied. We kept on studying from morning to evening. And after the war, the first thing I wanted was a book, was a Talmudic treatise. I never stopped studying. That probably saved me.
In your first novel, Night.
Night was not a novel, it was a memoir.
I don't know why I think of it as a novel.
Oh, no.
I think of it as a very autobiographical novel.
It is autobiography, but yeah. Every word is true.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about your religious teacher who narrowly escaped from being murdered with hundreds or thousands of other Jews in the forest by the SS, and he somehow managed to escape and come back to your village to warn people about what was happening, and no one would listen.
We didn't listen because he was a simple man. He was a beadle. Had he been an important person, I think some people would have listened. What is so extraordinary is when we remember today the silence, the indifference of so many people who were not inside the tragedy, but on the other side. Just imagine if we had heard on the radio Ben-Gurion from Israel, or Roosevelt, or Churchill, telling Hungarian Jews, don't go because they are killing, they are massacring. I think we would have believed them. But why should one believe a beadle, a man who came back from the other side and who is telling such atrocious stories?
Well, getting back to the question of madness, I think a lot of people in your village just assumed he'd lost his mind and was was having visions or something, that this couldn't possibly have happened.
Oh, absolutely. I myself, I was very close to him. And we spent many, many hours alone together every evening. And I would listen to him. First, I love to listen to stories, even to his stories, maybe especially to his stories. But I didn't believe them.
Did you do anything to mentally prepare for what was in store when your father told you that the next day the whole village was going to be deported, the whole ghetto was going to be deported?
No, we didn't know. You see, Hungarian Jewry was deported at such a pace. Everything came so fast. Look, the Hungarians allowed the Germans to come in March. The end of May, all the Jews were out already in Germany. In less than 6 weeks, Eichmann had managed to deport to their death more than 600,000 Jews, men, women, and children. So it came very fast, and it ended very fast. We didn't have time to think.
You've described yourself as having been very weak and sickly when you were young. I know you think of yourself as having survived purely by chance. Did you learn things, though, to help you survive when you were in the camps?
Oh, no, not at all. I was the wrong person, the wrong candidate for survival. I was always weak, as you said, and disarmed, cowardly. I would never try to do anything which was not what I could have done or should have done. I never asked for a supplement of anything. I didn't volunteer. I was always pleased to think that I could be invisible. Not to make myself visible was my task. I don't know why I survived. I don't know how I survived. It was really by accident.
Writer and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel is my guest. Did you know when you got out of the camps that you wanted to write?
Oh, I knew that I was going to write before I entered the camps. I come from a tradition, from the Jewish tradition, which believes in words, in language, in communication. And already at the age of 12 or 13, I was writing. Of course, it wasn't good. It meant nothing, but I tried to write. I even found the manuscript when I went back to my hometown. It's not good, but I tried. Afterwards, I knew I would have to bear witness. Everyone who was there is a witness. And everyone who was there is a true witness. Others who are trying to speak about this subject occasionally are false witnesses. And I felt that I had to be a true witness, and therefore I decided to wait for 10 years, not to speak about it, not to use language related to these experiences until I knew that the words were true words.
Why 10 years? Why not 5 years? Why not 1 year? No, seriously, what made you think that 10 years is what you needed to really know what it was you wanted to say and what words you wanted to say it with?
Well, 10 is a biblical figure, you know, and it's a good figure. Why not? I cannot tell you that I got up one morning and decided, let's see, is it 5 or 6 or 7? It entered my mind, it has to be 10. I decided 10.
Did you actually have an anniversary where, like, the 10th, really?
Absolutely.
And that day you sat down to write?
Right.
And is that when you started to write Night?
I wrote Night, yes. That's when I wrote Night, on April 11, 1955, which is 10 years later.
And looking back, do you think that this was definitely the right thing to do, to wait those 10 years? In what ways were you changed as a witness and as a writer during those 10 years?
Maybe I didn't change, but the words in me changed. They grew. You know, words have a strange destiny too. They grow, they get old, they die, they come back. Words can be turned into spears. They can be turned into prayers. It's a strange world that you are in when you deal with words.
In one of your essays, you wrote that after the war, you deliberately avoided all contact with Germans and that their presence sickened you physically. Did that change, and if so, what changed that?
It did. Well, I didn't want to go back to Germany, really. I went once because I didn't want to judge people. I went once in the early 60s to do a piece for commentary. And I realized that every person I see in the street, I judge him or her, asking where was he, what did he do, how old is he, could he have been there? And I didn't want that role, so I didn't go back. But I did go back last year, or in 86, 87. And look, today you have a young generation of Germans, and I do not believe in collective guilt. So I have absolutely no problem with the young Germans. I even feel sorry for the young Germans, because to be maybe sons or daughters of killers is different than to be sons and daughters of the victims. And I felt sorry for them. I still do.
You have a son. And I'm wondering if when your son was born, it helped give you a reason to live beyond bearing witness?
Well, it's enough, you know. To bear witness can be a very exalting undertaking. To have a son is also to bear witness. A son who has the name of my father is an important statement. But it is true that the birth of my son divided my life.
The generations of survivors are getting older. The older generation of survivors is no longer with us. Are you concerned about what's going to happen after the generations of survivors pass on? Like, who will be around to actually speak the memories?
Oh, I'm profoundly concerned, naturally. In one of my novels, I try to describe that feeling of the last survivor, what it means to be the very last. And I would not want to be that last survivor. But on the other hand, we are leaving a legacy. We are bequeathing a certain message, a certain story. This tragedy is the most documented tragedy in recorded history. And therefore, later on, if there will be a later on, anyone wishing to know will know where to go for knowledge.
Elie Wiesel, recorded in 1988. This is Fresh Air.